You have 15 minutes and you've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal, so you've got 10 minutes.
Very good, thank you, and may it please the honorable members of this court. Mr. Randall Lewis Kinlaw was convicted in York County Circuit Court in October of 2015 of robbery and use of a firearm in the commission of that robbery. I'm not going to go back over everything that's in the brief, but the relevant facts regarding that use of the firearm is that the clerk of the jewelry salon, Stephanie Lassley, indicates that note was handed to her, slid across the desk to her, stating something along the lines of, "I have a gun, I don't want to hurt you." Now, we have to say something along the lines of, because that note was never recovered, and it was not ever produced into evidence, so we only have what Ms. Lassley remembered that note as saying. Now, when we're looking at 18.2-53.1, stating that it is unlawful for any person to use or attempt to use any firearm or to display such weapon in a threatening manner while committing or attempting to commit certain enumerated felonies, in this case, a robbery. There are cases that have pointed or made that more pointed in terms of elements, including the case that we rely on, Des Feely from 2011, which is actually quoting the Thomas case from 1997, which comes out of the Yarborough case from 1994. And there are four specific elements to that. The first element is that the defendant has to have possessed an object. And I know that there are going to be a litany of cases that the Commonwealth is going to rely on which states that there have been convictions of this statute in which no firearm was ever recovered or really even seen. And it is not my purpose to try to overturn all of those cases. We can argue whether they were rightly decided or wrongly decided because the element still shepherdizes good law, even though in those cases not all of the elements were fulfilled. But that's not my purpose. My purpose is to distinguish this case, the Kinlaw case, the instant case, from even those, such as Courtney, Howell, Yarborough, Elmore. All of those had something in common. And that something in common is that first element that we just spoke of, that the defendant possessed an object. The second element is that that object is a firearm. The third element is that the defendant used it or attempted to use it or display it in a threatening manner. And, of course,
wouldn't all those cases though suggest that whether the person had an object is a perception of the victim as to whether or not the individual had an object?
Well, I guess, you know, not to be too clever, but I guess then we would have to define, you know, what is the perception and why was it perceived. In Courtney, the defendant held something under his shirt, which was tested, the testimony and the facts say that he was pointing his finger under his sweatshirt to resemble a firearm, and later a fake firearm was found in his car. In Powell, the defendant kept his hand in the pocket. His hand was the object in that case, and that the witnesses described him as being constantly fidgety with his hand in his pocket, presumably as if that hand were a weapon. In Yarborough,
doesn't the question of perception come down to the reasonableness of the perception as determined by the fact finder?
Well, I think it might, except that in this case, even in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, if you have insufficient evidence or no evidence to support, and our contention is in this case, other than what was read allegedly on that note, there was no other indication. There was no activity by Mr. Kinlaw, no fidgeting in the pocket, no object. So there was no evidence of the first element or the second element or really even the third element. So that's what we're saying, is that without that object or a finger or any other type of thing that could be misconstrued reasonably by the victim, then our contention is that it is not, it's an abuse of discretion that there is no evidence to support that Mr. Kinlaw had an object.
But
and
Mr. Allen, you can't say from this record that there's no evidence to support that he had an object, can you, in light of the fact that there was a note that said, gun?
Well, the note is not the object in terms of how the elements consider an object, but the second element saying that that object was a firearm, the note is merely the communication. In other words, it would have been the same if Mr. Kinlaw had simply stated, I have a gun and I don't want to hurt you. That's so when we talk about an object, we're not talking about the method by which the alleged threat is communicated, but rather the object in terms of the elements of being the actual firearm. And all of the other cases that we see, there is some object, whether it's a can of beer, as in Yarborough, or in the Elmore case, which this court used in its per curiam opinion, which stated that the person pushed, the defendant pushed an object against the victim's back and threatened to shoot if the victim moved, even though no firearm was found. That's the Elmore case that the Court of Appeals used in its per curiam opinion on this very case. We don't have any of that. There's no testimony in the record that the gun was even referred to, that Mr. Kinlaw looked at his pocket, held his jacket out as if the object could be contained in there. And the concern is, if you look at these four elements in terms of a baseball analogy, perhaps, you have to have an object to get to first base. The Commonwealth would have us scoring the run of element four before the ball is really even put into play, because the object is the ball in this case. The defendant did not possess an object before. Yes.
The victim doesn't need to have seen the object, correct?
They don't have to necessarily have seen it, no, but they do have to perceive it in some way. In other words, with Elmore, an object being pushed into somebody's back, of course, that victim didn't see that object, but it was still perceived. It was felt. The perception could be that most often it could be seen. It could be heard in terms of the racking of the slide of a shotgun or the cocking back of a hammer of a pistol behind someone's back. When you talk about perceived, most commonly it's seen, or something is seen that can be demonstrative of the fact that somebody actually has an object. And as far as the perception of the victim, a lot is made. In fact, the Commonwealth even says it specifically, where Miss Lashley was, the threats and orders demonstrated that she did indeed believe Kinlaw had a firearm. She never stated that specifically, and in fact, immediately before that, they talk about something which I believe is the true impetus for her fear, and that Mr. Kinlaw is alleged to have taken her purse, taken her operator's license out of the purse, photographed the license, and said something to the effect of, now, I don't want to hear anything in the news about this incident, or I know where to find you, or words to that effect. And that is why she did what she did in compliance with his orders, rather than her real belief, which is not in the record, that he ever actually had a firearm. And I would submit that it's those that explicit threat that has caused her to do what she did, rather than the implied threat as communicated in perhaps a case like McBride versus Commonwealth, the implied threat of a firearm. It wasn't the implied threat of a firearm, but the real threat that he would find her later if she didn't obey his commands. And I think if we get to the point where we're saying, okay, there's no object perceived, there's a threat that's allegedly communicated, but there's no object perceived, there's no activity by the defendant, which is indicative that he specifically is in possession of a firearm, then we kind of go loose from the moorings, and it's not a huge logical leap to say then, well, if Robert comes into a place of business and says, give me all the money, or I'm going to go to Bass Pro Shops, buy a weapon, and come back and shoot you with it. Now, obviously, I don't think that would be use of a firearm in commission of a felony, and if we say that this case is use of a firearm in the commission of a felony, I think what we're really saying is, it's not the object, it's the idea of the object which is used, and that's not what the statute contemplates, and it's certainly not one of the specifically enumerated elements. Again, possessed an object. That object was a firearm, that the defendant used it or attempted to use it or display it in a certain manner and during the commission of a robbery. I think we can distinguish ourselves in this case from Courtney, from Powell, from Yarborough, and Elmore, all of which had some object and activity subsequent to the communicated threat of the defendant that would lead the victim to believe that a firearm was actually in play. And barring any other questions, I would reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Thank you. Any other questions from the other judges? Judge Chafin?
No, thank you.
Judge Alston?
Not at this time. Not at this time.
Okay. Mr. Obenshain, you have 15 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Chris Obenshain representing the Commonwealth in this matter. Kinlaw has conceded the fact that he committed the robbery. The only question facing the court today is whether he can be convicted for use of a firearm in the course of that robbery when nobody saw a firearm. And the answer to that question is yes. Under Courtney and the other cases that have been cited by the Commonwealth in our brief, it's not necessary for somebody to see a firearm or to be able to identify a firearm in order for someone to be convicted of use of a firearm and commission of a felony. Here, in order to meet those first two elements of the offense of 18.253.1, that the defendant possessed an object and that the object was a firearm, here we have uncontroverted testimony that the defendant made the statement through a note, "I have a gun, and I don't want to hurt you. Give me the money." That was the note that was passed to Ms. Lasley. That testimony was uncontroverted, and in fact, the trial court noted when it ruled on the motion to strike, page 88 of the appendix, that there isn't even a conflict in the evidence, which is distinguished from Courtney and some of the other cases. There was no testimony presented, no evidence presented to contradict Ms. Lasley's testimony that this note was handed to her. And so as a result, the trial court did not err in crediting that testimony and in determining as a result of that testimony that the defendant did in fact have a gun.
Robinson?
Yes, Your Honor.
Since it's the Commonwealth's burden to prove the offense, how do you appropriately use the absence of evidence?
Well, Your Honor, I think this goes to kind of the second point that that Mr. Allen was making in terms of the threat. The trial court had to examine the totality of the circumstances to determine whether it was reasonable for Ms. Lasley to believe that the defendant possessed a firearm. And in all of those cases that he attempts to distinguish, you know, some of those facts of an individual having a hand in the pocket or something to that effect, those go to the totality of the circumstances. In this case, the totality of the circumstances demonstrate that what gave force to the threat was his assertion that he had a gun. So it wasn't just the threat, it wasn't just his threats that he didn't want to hurt her, that he could find her later if she didn't, you know, lie to the police, those types of things. What gave force to those threats was his initial assertion that I have a gun. And she certainly responded in a way that would indicate she believed that he had a gun. He told her to put her hands up. She put her hands up. He ordered her to go to the back of the store. She followed his directions. He asked her, you know, for an identification. She went and got it. I mean, she complied with all of his orders because he had initially threatened the fact that he had a gun, that he didn't want to hurt her, but that essentially, you know, implying that he could if he wanted to. And so,
counsel, Mr. Obenshain, Judge Alston again. In these kinds of cases, and in these circumstantial cases, and that's what I'm going to call this kind of case, sometimes I look to the purpose behind particular statutes as to whether or not the behavior that's involved here is culpable or not. What would you suggest is the purpose of the legislation enhancing the exposure for a criminal defendant when a firearm is used?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the Holloman case, Holloman v. Commonwealth, 1980 Virginia Supreme Court case, says it very clearly. The purpose of Code Section 18.253.1, keyed to serious crimes and prescribing inflexible penalties, is to deter violent criminal conduct. And so in cases such as this, the purpose is to deter individuals from using firearms that may cause additional harm and to deter that violent criminal conduct. If this court were to adopt the rule or the analysis that is proposed by the defendant in this case, it would simply reward individuals who were, you know, skilled at concealing their firearm. And I think that would go against the legislative intent of this statute, which is to deter violent criminal conduct. It's to deter individuals from using firearms or the threat of firearms to effectuate other criminal acts. And
so you would focus on the second component of Holloman, and that is the threat of the use of a firearm as opposed to the actual possession of a firearm, which would also, you know, bring about culpable behavior. So in this case, you would focus on the threat of the use of the firearm and not so much whether one was recovered or not.
Yes, that's correct. And certainly, you know, a firearm doesn't have to be recovered. You know, again, we're not going to reward, you know, individuals who are able to use a firearm to effectuate their crimes and then able to successfully conceal it or get rid of it. The question is whether that firearm or the threat of that firearm was used to commit the crime, and here it clearly was. Here it was the threat of the gun that instilled fear in the young lady and caused her to, you know, hand over the money and also follow all of the other instructions that he gave her. So it was that threat of physical violence that was, you know, essential here. And, you know, and I think that's, you know, what distinguishes this case from the Yarborough case is that obviously the amount of time that transpired in between the crime and when the individual was recovered, but also the fact that in Yarborough there was a reasonable hypothesis of innocence. In other words, there was an item that was found on Yarborough immediately after he committed the crime that, you know, explained what the victim's perception might have been, which was the beer can. Here we don't have that. There's no conflicting evidence indicating that there was anything other than a gun.
In other words, the facts in that case explain the misperception of the victim as opposed to the perception of the victim.
Exactly. Exactly, Your Honor. So,
Mr. Chang?
Yes, Your Honor.
What is your response to Mr. Allen's point about the requirement of an object?
Well, in other words, he
parses it and says, evidence must show that there's the existence of an actual object.
First of all, Your Honor, I would respond that in this case, the defendant claimed to have an object. He claimed to have a gun. So that is evidence, and that was uncontroverted. So that from that evidence, the trial court could reasonably conclude, could draw a reasonable inference from that circumstantial evidence that he had an object that was a gun. So I think both of those elements are satisfied by the defendant's own claim to have a gun. Additionally, I don't think the cases that have been cited stand for the proposition that there has to be some evidence of a physical object that's seen. For example, if somebody were to, you know, the Elmore case where someone comes up behind someone and they never see the object. Now, obviously, in Elmore, they felt the object, but let's say the facts are a little bit different and that gun wasn't pressed to the person's back or back of the head. The claim in and of itself, I have a gun, you know, is sufficient without any contradictory evidence that the object was something else or that there was some other object. That's sufficient to to support the inference that the person had a gun. So just because the person doesn't see it or maybe doesn't feel it, that's not determinative. It's a totality of the circumstances analysis, and the trial court in this case clearly did that analysis and credited Ms. Lasley's testimony and the fact that there was no testimony that refuted the fact that he had a gun goes to support that those elements of the offense. Unless there are any other questions, the Commonwealth would rely on its arguments on brief.
Thank you, Mr. Obenchain. Judge Alston, do you have anything?
No, ma'am. Thank you.
Judge Chafin?
No, nothing further. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Allen, you now have five minutes.
Mr. Allen, before you get started, Mr. Allen, I have a question for you. As I hear Mr. Obenchain's argument, and if I mischaracterize it, I apologize, Mr. Obenchain, but what he's essentially saying is that we have a situation here where your client has essentially admitted that he has a gun, and by sort of ignoring his admission, we're sort of sanitizing the evidence. What would be your suggestion in response to that, sir?
Well, I wouldn't claim it, or I wouldn't characterize it as an admission, because an admission, even in legal terms, has to have some other scintilla of evidence. You can't just come in and claim I was the shooter on the grassy knoll that killed JFK. There has to be some evidence to support it. Here, there is no other evidence other than that claim, and that's what I would characterize it as, a claim rather than an admission. And according to Mr. Obenchain, he talks about the claim of having an object is sufficient. However, if that were the case, then it would make all of the elements, especially the first element of the crime, completely irrelevant. Because it says the defendant has to possess an object, not claim to possess an object. He has to actually possess the object. And I understand it makes it a little bit murky because the Despuley in 2011, the Thomas in 97, the Yarbrough in 94, where these specific elements are elucidated, still shepherdizes good law, as well as a lot of cases which would at first blush tend to not fulfill those objects. That may be something that has to be reconciled by the courts at some later date, but I don't think we need to do that here, because here we don't even have an object, which we do in every single other case, object and action. If the object is a can of beer, if it's a toy gun, if it's a finger, if it's a hand, if it's some other unseen object that is felt, or in the hypos that I constructed where it's heard, or something of that nature, it would just seem to me that you cannot score the run until you get to first base, and that first base is the defendant actually possessed an object, that object was a firearm, that object was used or displayed in a threatening manner during the commission of a robbery.
Mr. Allen, it seems like, I mean, you make a very good, passionate argument for your client, but it seems like the Supreme Court of Virginia in Powell has foreclosed a good part of what you were saying, because in Powell, the court made very clear distinguished between the difference between a confession, an extrajudicial confession, and a perpetrator's statement that he has a gun, and essentially strongly implies that you don't need corroboration for that. And in Powell, there was no gun or no object found, right?
In Powell, it seems to be that the hand, the defendant's actual hand, was the object. In other words, he's got his hand in his pocket, and it's fidgeting. The witness say he's fidgeting with his hand in his pocket, which people tended to, in that particular case, assume that hand was the gun, or was holding the gun that was kept hidden from their view inside the pocket. And I think that would be the object that was in Powell.
Well, in this case, didn't the trial judge find, as a matter of fact, that the clothing that the defendant was wearing would have been sufficient for hiding such a weapon, and he had enough time between the time he was apprehended and the event to have disposed of the gun?
Well, I certainly understand. He did rule that, Your Honor. That's correct. And really, I don't know that just because somebody's clothes had the ability to conceal a weapon is evidence that he actually had a weapon. And it certainly is not evidence that he, number one, possessed an object. So I think what we're looking at then is things that could possibly come into play later to secrete or even get rid of the object. But I think we still have to have evidence of the object, and in this case, we just simply don't have that evidence, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
You're welcome. I guess that's the time that we...
No, you actually have about 4 more minutes.
Unless there are other questions, I would concede the rest of my time.
Okay. Judge Alston, do you have any questions?
No, ma'am.
Judge Chaffin?
No, thank you.
Well, thank you both for very, very nice arguments. Very good job on both parts. The case is now submitted to the court, and we will adjourn to go into